What is an unpreached truth? Well, we talk about that today with my guest and more. But before we do that, I just want to remind you that I'm Eric Jean-Baptiste and you're listening to Youth Ministry and Mentorship 101, where we are on the journey together on how to engage, empower, and enlighten our youth and young adults better by having honest conversations with one another. People who are in this field and people who are ministers, people who are leaders, we're just learning from one another because we're all on the same boat. The boat that is on this proverbial journey to evangelize and spread the gospel. Jesus is coming soon, and the work that needs to be done has to be done with everybody, and that includes our youth and young adults. So we're learning from each other, we're ministering to each other, we're listening to each other, we're mentoring one another. So if you haven't followed me on Instagram, feel free to do so at youth_mentor101, where you will find little snippets of this podcast and the link tree that leads you to the Facebook page, the YouTube page, and of course, the podcast to which you're listening to, which is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, I speak with Pastor Nikolai Greaves, who is a pastor in the Lake Region Conference, and he also has a podcast by the name of God and Money, the Unpreached Truth, where he talks about money and how we don't really talk about it, even though the Bible talks about it a lot. We talk about other things that he's experiencing as a pastor, as a person of color in a regional conference. So he makes it plain. He talks from his heart. And it's a powerful and interesting episode. So check it out after the ad. Hey, everybody. Eric Jean-Baptiste here. I am with Pastor Nikolai Greaves, a pastor in Lake Region Conference and also a fellow podcast host. His podcast goes by the name of God and Money, the Unpreached Truth. How you doing today, Pastor?
Doing well. Grateful to be here. Grateful for the opportunity.
All right. Well, let's get right into it. If you could just give us a short bio about yourself and what led you to where you are now in ministry.
All right, cool. Well, in a nutshell, I consider myself an average guy just trying to live right, but born and raised on the island of Barbados. Shout out to all the Bajans out there. Moved to the United States at a young age, grew up in Berrien Springs, Michigan, went to Ruth Murdoch Academy. Later after Academy, I went down to Atlanta, Georgia, where I did my first year at Georgia Perimeter College. And then I transferred to Washington Adventist University in Maryland, where I studied business administration pre-law, did my MBA there, and then later came back to Berrien Springs to Andrews University to study the Master of Divinity program. And now I pastor three churches, Park Avenue, Lebanon SDA Church, and Mount Sinai SDA Church in Champaign, Decatur, Peoria, respectively. Wife, two kids, Zion and Zanwe. My wife is diehard respiratory therapist, director of respiratory, so she's out there fighting COVID-19. Shout out to her. She also has a podcast, Health for the Healthcare Professional, for all the people who are in the healthcare sector, and also got a 8-month-old German Shepherd that terrorizes everything around our house. But just had a variety of experiences over the years in business and education and finance, and just really saw that there was a disconnect from a theological standpoint and from a practical standpoint in terms of the use of money. A lot of people, I've had the privilege of pastoring people in a variety of communities. Some of them are underprivileged communities. And it's quite interesting when people from the community come up to you and they're asking for prayer requests, and the kind of prayer requests they're asking about are things you don't even think about when life is going well. You know, Lord, help me get gas in my car. How do I take care of my rent? And I thought there was a conundrum that was taking place where we would tell people, okay, we know all the texts to, you know, bring you all the tithe to the storehouse. Nobody knows what to do with the 90%. So I thought it was my responsibility to inform people what to do with the 90% and to help them navigate this territory where they think somehow God is going to kick them out of the kingdom because of what's in the bank account. And so that's kind of where this journey began. So that in a nutshell, a brief bio. As questions develop, I'm sure I'll be able to try and answer some more things, but at least off the top of the head.
Oh man, I love that, how you said, we don't know what to do with the 90%. Man, that's a powerful statement right there, because I'm trying to go through my mind as well. I mean, we love to talk about tithes and offering.
Absolutely.
But we hardly do talk about that over, and that's a massive amount when I think about it. The offering, of course, is on top of the 10%, but
yeah,
that's still a good amount of money that we should still be learning how to manage it. And basically, from listening to your podcast and your experience, God does give instruction how to handle it. Am I
absolutely
right?
Yes, absolutely. From Deuteronomy, where God says, don't forget the Lord who causes you to have wealth, to the kings that he sets up, to the early church, where they were giving in distribution. There was a complaint that came up by the Greeks saying, hey, we're not receiving fair distribution. And the Bible says they had everything in common, right? Are we yet at a place in church where if somebody sees themselves as a member and somebody needs a car, that the other person say, well, use my car? We're not there. There was this system in place where people gave and lended to each other so that they would not have to borrow from somebody outside of the group. God gives many commandments about borrowing, not loan. If you're going to loan money, not loaning at an interest rate. But in our system, of course, now in America, we put interest on everything. We compound that interest, and a whole bunch of people are in debt. And I just think it's deeply problematic, because in some respects, and I'm not saying that this is the intent, I'm just saying that this is sometimes how people process it. Sometimes you can think about tithing as a tax. So you come into church, you remember to take care of that tax, and then throughout the week, you may be bad at math, or you may be bad with your habits. But I learned very quickly in talking with people and just looking at life experiences, many people finance their sin. So they'll go out and they'll have an addiction, they'll have something that they have to do, and the Spirit of God hasn't been able to resolve that yet in their mind, so they go out and do it, right? We know that in consumer finance, a lot of this advertising or whatever else is based on mentality. So you go out and you go spend your money on things to satisfy something that's not really going to satisfy you, and you end up going broke in the process, right? Why is the reason why people who play the lotto, when they win the millions, most of them, if I think all of them, if I want to say that accurately, but most of them end up in a worse financial state than they first started. Wow. How's that possible? You win like $10 million and then it's blown, because there's something going on with your mind, and God has to be able to help you with that, as well as you make sense of what you're doing with your finance, so that you don't succumb to your desires and use it to have self-gratification, or use your finances to oppress other people. Your finances have to be used to make a difference in somebody's life in a positive sense. The parable of Good Samaritan, he spent money. We always talk about the good gesture of him picking up the person on the broken road and putting him on his beast and taking them to the inn. But he did spend money. He spent his own resources, and then he spent money. So how much more than we should be able to understand what to do after we have returned our tithe and offerings? What do we do throughout the week? What do we do in our lifetime to make sure that we're stewards of the finances that God gave us?
Wow. Yeah. I'm trying to think about it, and it's interesting how we do have like a culture that says in our churches that says, you know, we tell the story of the rich young ruler a lot. I think that's the story that comes to mind when it comes to, can we be rich and can we have wealth? And we think of the rich young ruler and how he wasn't willing to part with his riches to follow Jesus.
Right.
So when people bring up that story, how do you respond to that when they say, you know, well, doesn't that, you know, and Jesus said it's harder for a rich man to go through the eye of a needle than to enter the kingdom of heaven? What, how do you respond to that?
Absolutely. I respond by telling them to read the rest of the story, because the rest of the story, they said, well, then who can be saved? And he said, with man, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. Jesus did not spend his ministry only reaching out to the poor. He also had connections. Nicodemus has money, right? We don't ever want to see these kind of things in the text, because we want to keep a narrative that somehow there's a correlation between poverty and riches. So the poorer you are and the more destitute you are, because we take the text where it says, you know, the Son of Man have nowhere to lay his head. So we think that God is like us, right? So he didn't have anything. I don't have anything. So I'm more like God. That's far from the truth. We also have to, I also invite people to read other areas of the Bible. How do we skip over the entire Old Testament, jump into the New Testament and find one or two passages in that way? Mm-hmm. You look at the Old Testament and you see that slaves were taken out of slavery, brought into the wilderness, and then brought into this, to a land flowing with milk and honey, and they're given resources and wealth beyond measure. And God then tells them, do not forget me. And what do they do in the narrative? They forget him, and then all sorts of foolishness happens. Eden, from all practical purposes, Eden, there's a garden located in Eden, and all of the resources are there. No matter how much you eat, no matter how many people populate the planet, there's enough for everybody. Sin creates a socioeconomic problem where now you have a haves and haves not. People are starting to fight over resources, and that's the same thing that happens in our century now. We fight over resources. All this, the diamonds, the gold, the oil, stocks, business deals, whatever, we fight to have power for resources so that at the end of the day, we can eat and feed our families. And so we have to put into context, like look at the narrative of Solomon. Solomon said, come up to me. I'm sorry. God said to Solomon, ask me anything and I'll give it to you. He's like, okay. He looked at his family situation and the dynamics, and perhaps that was what was problematic to him. He's like, I need some wisdom. And apparently God said, not only will I give you wisdom, I'm also going to make you the wealthiest person on earth. Why? Why not? Why was not the intellectual thunderstorm enough? The quest of knowledge, the scientist that he would be. Why wasn't that simply enough? God wanted to allow him access. Now, of course, we later realize in Ecclesiastes, he said, I literally did everything that I wanted to do. Every desire I wanted to do, I had women, I had stuff. I mean, this man is wealthy. And then he concluded, out of all of the experiences that he had, he came up with several different points that I think are good for people to consider. But at the end, he said, the most important thing that matters is to fear God and keep his commandments and have and give glory to him. For whatever you do, it's going to be coming into judgment anyway, and you're going to go to the grave. So we will take that text and spin it in a way like, oh, well, since everyone's going to die, don't use money, don't spend money. Look at the example of Solomon. But there were other good things that could be done with those finances. Abraham apparently had so much stuff that he had a private army of 300 people.
Yep.
When his family member got kidnapped, he decided to go in, like, let me go in there and take care of this myself. I'm not waiting for anybody. I'm just, and the Lord blessed him and he took care of it. And then he said to them, I don't want your stuff, lest you're going to say that you made me rich. God is the one who made me rich. So I think at the end of the day, God cares less about how much is in one's bank account and more about what's in somebody's heart. Mm-hmm. And the human predicament, other than this issue of, you know, how can I escape this issue of sin and be saved? Part of the challenge is anytime that God gives people stuff or power, people often use it for themselves or oppress somebody else. And that becomes deeply problematic because God does not want people to misuse resources in a way that make some people less than and some people greater than. It was always to elevate. He said, you know, look out for the orphan, the oppressed, the poor, the widow, etc., the foreigner, the immigrant, right? So I think there's a level of responsibility that we have as people, not just to be responsible for our finances, but also to think bigger beyond ourselves. Like, do we just want a large house, a nice car, and to say, hey, my lawnmower is bigger than yours? Or do we want to also figure out how to solve some of the issues of poverty, solve some of the issues of corrupt businesses in some communities? And money talks, right? We know money has power. A lot of the things that we want to see changing in the world can change if you put up enough funds to make that change happen. You know, we give big shout outs to Bill Gates and all these other wealthy people, Elon Musk, right? And I don't know what the religious standing is, but they literally saw a problem in the world and they're deciding to fix it with their money. How many God-fearing people are walking on the earth trying to do the same thing? Or are we all trying to have like a poverty contest and see who's more, you know, who's more noble by giving away the most stuff to in the sense that I don't have anything left. And then I just, you know, so anyways, I could go on and on about that. But
oh, wow. Yeah. Another one that I wanted to bring up with you is the fourth commandment. And it mentions, you know, your male servant, your female servant, your ox. So this is referring to the command is given to somebody who has stuff, who has some wealth. So in do you find in that commandment, it's like saying God is giving the opportunity to all that follow him, the opportunity to attain wealth on this earth. But it's what we do with it that's what's really important.
Absolutely. And I think it also speaks to people who are in a position of power and ownership. And I want to say ownership per se, but ownership in part and stewardship in part. Even people who work for you, you are responsible for. I don't recall if it was T.D. Jakes, but I remember there was a leader that was being interviewed. And he said, I used to think about my success based on how much money I have. But now I think about my success about how many families I feed. I think that's a radical shift in your thinking. When you can get to a place where you see yourself responsible for families. If I don't allow this organization to succeed, if I don't try to do right by business, families will not be able to take care of themselves. And so a staff of 300 is no longer 300 people that I could just fire at will. Staff of 300 is 300 families that I'm responsible for, probably more, depending to extended family and what the circumstances are. But even for the Shabbat, the rest that takes place, it is a call from for people who are seeking to attain wealth and to be part of that rat race and to have growth, to even step aside and recognize that they're created, and at Shabbat, everybody rests, not just the person who has the luxury to rest, right? We know of people who have nice businesses and they go off and play golf and they relax and go on vacation while everyone's working hard, making the money. Mm. Sabbath calls for everybody to rest. So there becomes a moral responsibility even for the CEO, for the person who has staff, that within all possibility, if it's not a life and death situation or an issue of national security, let the people rest and experience the rest that you get to experience. And that becomes a privilege every 7 days. So I think there's something about Sabbath. We've always guarded it from a way like of what you can do or what you cannot do, rather than looking at it as an experience for families to rest and to recognize and to be connected with each other, but also connected to God.
Wow. So, man, I'm listening to all these insights that you have, and I definitely can see that it's because, you know, you did study this. You have your MBA. But when you gave your bio, you said you went to, you lived in Berrien Springs, went to Ruth Murdoch. It sounds like perhaps was your father a pastor or...
Wow. So dad is, it was a bit of a complicated situation. So dad has always been involved in ministry, and he has pastored. If he walks around right now, shout out to George Graves in Barbados right now. He retired last year as the director for University of Southern Caribbean campus in Barbados. He's always been involved in ministry, from pastoring a local church to running a university to being involved in nonprofit work over the years. But Dad's worldview has always been, and I mean, he can always call me to see if I can correct this, but from my understanding, his worldview has always been being in relationship with God calls for you to do it outside of the building.
Okay.
Sometimes we get caught up in titles and status and accolades and how we should be seen by people. And the way that Dad always approached things was doing things because they're the right thing to do. So I don't do this thing where I, for example, I did not wait to become a pastor to be involved in X, Y, and Z. I did not wait for a title at my job to do X, Y, and Z. I just did it. And as I was doing it, it qualified me to be where I am. And so I think that's the approach that Dad has always tried to distinguish over the years. If you're a janitor, if you're a trash person, if you're a entrepreneur, whatever you do, make sure that you put your best foot forward. Do it because it's the right thing to do. Allow excellence to happen. And your journey with God, like, we reduce calling to just what happens from the pulpit. Your calling is on your life. So anything, any space that you end up in, represent God in that way. So that then removes the angst that I need the position in order to fulfill the call. The wow. call comes with your existence, because God created you to be somebody that nobody else can be.
Man, I'm so happy you said that. It's something I strongly believe in as well. And I wanted to comment on that, because I usually, when I speak with pastors who were, are still technically PKs, pastors' kids,
yeah,
they grow up saying, I don't want to be a pastor. I don't want to be a pastor. I don't want to be a pastor. And then the Holy Spirit hits them massively. And then they say, well, I have no choice. But yeah. I think the way you mentioned how your father's worldview was different, in the sense that ministry is not the title, mm-hmm. it affected your worldview as well. And you don't see it as having to get the title. You always saw yourself as a minister, no matter what. So
absolutely. Now, granted, I will say, for the record, because God is watching, I did kick and scream. You know, I was upset. I didn't say, but my upsetness was not in relationship to being a pastor just because of being a pastor. My upsetness was, number one, I wanted to make sure that I did not misunderstand what I was seeing. Being a pastor, people think you're going to go up there and preach. You're going to preach at these large conventions. You're like a miniature celebrity, right? Or at minimum, you're just laboring in the field. Nobody knows where you are, and you're dealing with all this stuff that you got to deal with. And I did not want to make the assumption, and this is just my mindset back then, I did not want to make the assumption, okay, God, I know where you brought me from. You took me from a place where I wasn't sure if you exist to, I know you exist. And I don't want to now stand there and be presumptuous that this is what I deserve, right? I have this religious experience, so therefore I deserve to be a pastor. Not doing that. So I always try to be involved in different ways to test out where God may be going with this. So I got involved a little bit in, like, I was working for government, but I was helping out at a church. Then I was working for the church, but I wasn't working as a pastor. And then I did trips overseas, and I was like, okay, but I'm going to come back and maybe I'm going to start my own, like, you know, organization to take care of homelessness or whatever, right? And then over the years, God will be like, not quite, not, no, wait. And then he would just roll me to where I need to be until I actually ended up in the seminary. But even afterwards, now that I'm pastoring, my view still is that the calling is on my life. So as I can't even in this role, I can't make the assumption that, okay, I'm here, so this is the final situation. Like, all I'm going to do is pastor 3 churches. I'm just going to be within this context, and then it's retirement. I don't know. I think that as long as I keep the same pathway of being open to what God wants, it's his plan, and I'm the vessel to be able to execute that plan in partnership with him, then as things grow, opportunities will come available. So, for example, I was recently asked by the mayor of Peoria to serve on the advisory committee for police and community relations. That is part of my calling. There are thousands of people who may have been selected for that. I was selected. So God has a plan. And isn't it interesting that we're going through all this stuff now with police reform and race relations, et cetera. And God timed everything from back then to now for this moment to occur. Yeah. So I think we have to sometimes... we are often taught sometimes in our faith groups to pray about receiving our daily bread. But we think that's the only thing we can ask God about. What if God is open to you asking about getting the bakery?
Wow.
We often think we just need this little bread thing. Why don't you ask God about the bakery? God, am I allowed to run the bakery? God, some people are asking themselves, well, you know, I want to work for somebody. Why not ask God, is it okay for you to start a business? God, I want to, you know, I just want to get into med school. Have you asked God, can you run the hospital? We don't think about those lines because in our mind, it lines up with this narrative that maybe, you know, humility means the lack thereof. I'm going to look, expect for little, receive for little, but you serve a large God. So the worst thing that can happen is God says no, and then he's still going to look out for you. Because by saying no, then he knows you're not ready for it, or it's not the season for it. So he's still going to look out for you. It's in the little things that we do. In fact, that's what he literally says. Who much is given, much is required. The little things, whatever you do in the little, then more will be given to you to take care of. So we have to shift our thinking and stop having fear that we're going to be embarrassed by God or that we're being presumptuous by just asking. He said, ask. He said, which person would ask for a fish and then somebody would give them a snake? He said, if you being evil know how to give good gifts to your children and you're evil, how much more would your heavenly Father give to those who ask? So we don't even imagine God doing that for us because of our insecurities or whatever else, but we have to cross the bridge of from false humility to true humility to recognize we're not entitled, but neither are we going to try to receive attention by saying that we're less than and that we're not worthy. You know how some of those people are. Yeah. You say, you know, good morning, how are you doing? Well, I'm just, you know, I'm just a sack of potatoes. Like, I can't believe I exist. Like, my goodness, like the more you down yourself, the more people will applaud you for the perception of you being humble when that's not real humility. Humility Wow. is just being in a space where you can be content, but also be open to expect more of God because you serve a big God. And if God doesn't do any more, be satisfied with that. But he will always elevate you in due season. And if he chooses not to, then that's the place you need to be and be cool with it. So I didn't mean to preach, but I felt like that.
That's perfect. I love it. This is great stuff. And what I wanted to also ask you, because this is something I get a lot from, because this is mentorship as well in the show, is pastors have told me that it's good to have, you know, another degree outside of ministry before heading to seminary and stuff like that. So, in your experience in that, how's that helped your ministry?
That's a good question. So there's two ways of looking at this. First and foremost, I strongly believe that God creates access to opportunities. I'm trying to be polite in my rhetoric. It doesn't always work out, but if it would not, you could have a juris doctorate, You could have a PhD. You could have 5 degrees under your name, and it may seem like you are qualified to do whatever the Lord has you to do. But without God, none of that stuff is going to work out. I've literally witnessed people think themselves to be so brilliant that they think God doesn't exist because of the degrees that they have. Mm. And they were in seminary at the time.
Wow.
I think it's very important, number one, to put God first in guiding your steps in terms of your education. Because sometimes what can happen, especially in the ministry, we do like this comparative contest. We see somebody else has this particular thing, so we go and do that thing, and we think it's going to yield the same result. I was recently having a conversation with somebody about this, and maybe in deep research you'll realize what some of my political views are, but I don't believe in equality of outcome. I believe in equality of opportunity, but not of outcomes. So you and I could have the same opportunities. You have an opportunity to get an MBA. Somebody else has an opportunity to get an MBA. But the outcomes cannot be manufactured in a way that we're all going to have the same thing in terms of the results. I think God is a very determining factor in terms of the direction of people's lives. So there's some people who are pursuing an MBA that may never use it in the ministry context. And it may just be for their own personal knowledge. And there are other people in who God, they were not expecting to use it, and then now they're using it. I don't think there's anything that's going to be useless, if that makes sense. If whatever, just like it was the 5 loaves, 2 fish situation, God can take whatever you have and expand on it. So there's nothing that won't be, it will be in vain. But I think sometimes there's a side of ministry that becomes so professional and so logical for people that they might sometimes push the God factor out. Mm-hmm. God is the one who establishes rulers and kings and sets people in high places. So some people may not have the same outcome because it just may not be their season yet. And God may know what he's doing in terms of putting the moves together. Now, with that being said, I would recommend, this is just now me just thinking, it won't hurt to educate yourself in a discipline outside of theology. The theological education that you receive is only going to give you the framework or the backdrop of how to guide your thinking and where to find information to support the theological position of the particular denomination that you serve. Or allow you the opportunity to think critically of other theological perspectives. Depending on the socioeconomic background of the person that you're dealing with, or the intellectual level of the person you're dealing with, some people may have theological questions, and other people, they're not even thinking about that. And part of the challenge that we often, there is a gap of information in terms of the people on the ground and what their concerns are and what we actually study academically. A person I know who is a, they work for a think tank. That's all I know. Okay. They say they work for a think tank. We have some deep conversations one-on-one. I mean, deep theological conversations and philosophical conversations. We can hang. And then I have some other people who they just want to know if God is going to take care of their rent. They don't know these terms. They don't know what the Greek and Hebrew says. That don't matter to them. They just want to know, what is God going to do about this? I've come to church today to try to understand what's going on with my life. My family is broken. I'm having marriage issues. My kids are going crazy. My cousin's in jail. I want to know if I'm going to survive tomorrow. And sometimes depending on, you know, when you have a bit of ease of life, you think about different level of things, right? When I lived in Hyattsville, Maryland, off of Eastern Avenue, it's in the hood. I was thinking how to get out of my house and not get shot, right? I was like outside of college. That was my apartment that I needed to stay. So I had to, like, literally there was a shooting that happened next door. So wow. I'm thinking, okay, they murdered this 21-year-old. I'm trying to get to my car so I can get to work. That's just all I want. I just want to get to my car to get to work. Wow. And then later in life, I'm not thinking about that because I don't live in that context anymore. But I do think about other things, and so it's useful information. But now when we're talking about like having a business background or a legal background or social work background or psychological background, there are other, or education, there are other areas that may assist, because the church has other areas of need that needs to be addressed. So even though our goal is to try and lead people to understand the scriptures and lead them into a relationship with Christ, there's also some practical things that need to happen on the ground on how to run a church building, how to deal with volunteers, how to deal with conflict, how to address, how do you get a grant so you don't lean on the tithe and offering? How do you fix the food deserts that are in our community? How do you deal with the financial illiteracy that happens in some of our communities? How do you guide people? Do you have a program that deals with Alcoholics Anonymous so that people who, and we think the alcoholic is the homeless man with the paper bag and the bottle. We don't think about an alcoholic wearing a suit and tie, driving the Porsche, and may be constantly thinking, I need to drive my car into the rail and commit suicide because I can't deal with the stress of managing millions of dollars. We don't think about that, but those people need a location too, and they need to know the Lord cares about them, right? So as God guides you, ask God to open your eyes to how these things can fit, because we don't need in all of our situations always people sitting at the pulpit giving a word. We also need people to be able to go outside the synagogue like Jesus and start impacting the community around us. And you need to have a variety of tools and skill sets in the new world we're in, right? Mid-COVID,
yeah.
Beyond just theological gymnastics that we sometimes orate from the pulpit. Those are good and those are important, but we need other skill sets as well.
Wow, great. I didn't want to end this podcast without addressing another topic. You're the guy. Your podcast is awesome when talking about God and money. But another topic that you have been very vocal about, and I've been listening to what you had to say, is your reaction to the racial tension that is in the United States after the murder of George Floyd and, the protests and everything. There's so much we could talk about it. That would be another podcast episode. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. One yeah. question that I just want to have, because this is a question that was actually asked to me just recently, and mm-hmm. that is, you're a pastor in Lake Region Conference.
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond to a pastor or a leader in a state conference who saw what happened, sees what's happening, and just says, man, how can we work together? How can we show the world that every race and color can come together and truly exhibit Christ's character? How would you mm-hmm. answer that question?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great question to ask. And I applaud anybody who's actively asking those questions in sincerity and in genuineness to understand. Sometimes you got to distinguish the questions that people pose because they're setting up the conversation about regional versus state conferences, right? So sometimes I shut that thing down so quickly, I don't want to hear it. Because it's honestly, if by now, and I grant there are people who don't know, but if you don't know why we have a regional conference, please read the history and then come back and talk. It's not to be rude. It's like asking the question, why are people protesting? When you read the history of the transatlantic slave trade, Jim Crow, redlining, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, you start going down the list, you start realizing that this is generations of frustration that takes place. Black owned doesn't mean black only. So we even have regional conferences that are multicultural. We have Korean pastors and African pastors and West Indian pastors and Caucasian pastors. I mean, seriously, right? But you don't want to see that in the spotlight because we always think there's this tug of war that takes place. But what I would say to somebody is, walk over to a pastor that's not in your conference or context and have a genuine conversation about their context, right? If we were to switch pulpits and communities, how would your sermons relate to the membership that I pastor versus the sermons that may or may not relate to the membership that you pastor, right? Now, here's the strange thing that has happened with me in quick about this. personal shout out to Pastor Matthew Lucio, because he pastors in Illinois Conference. Mm-hmm. We laugh about this all the time. He lives closer to my church on the other side of town where the black folks are.
Yeah.
And I live in the suburbs. And so we often joke about this notion, like I'm closer to his church and he's closer to my church, but we pastor in two different spaces. So we've talked over the years, we've swapped pulpits. I've preached at his church, preached at my church. We're friends. But when we're talking about this issue, we can have honest conversations about perception versus reality. I don't want to, there's a history and a context that he's bringing to the table, and there's a history and context I'm bringing to the table. And I'm a little bit on the outside, because I can also say, as a person that grew up in the islands, I've also grew up in the United States, I also understand the dynamic of other non-American blacks coming here and maybe making the assumption, like, why isn't it easy for you to get from, you know, from A to B? I think there's a history in the context of that. And I would argue that even in the islands and in Africa, there's issues of systemic racism there. It's just different. You don't own the beaches, you don't own the businesses. So we can have that conversation another time. But you need to go over and have conversations and see what the context is, right? Why is it that, and see, I don't want to call out certain people because I know them, but you hear stories about Harbor of Hope, how that came to fruition in Benton Harbor. You hear stories about black pastors who pastor predominantly white churches and some of the comments them and their families have had. I think it's just a matter of empathizing with the person's experience. You don't have, just like the parable of the Samaritan, you don't have to get beat up to recognize that somebody may be injured. You can still have empathy, sympathy, understand that the person is going through an experience, and I need to find some way of bridging this gap. Especially in the ministry. Ministry can be quite isolating sometimes and lonely and lone wolf. Instead of you talking to people of your same context, go over to somebody in your different context. And I would encourage that to my brothers and sisters who also work in the regional context. There's sometimes this notion that anytime a white person does something, it's racist. Like if I said good morning to somebody and they said, you know, they don't speak back to me, they must be racist, right? That's not always the case. They may have a bad day. So we have to have dialogue, because we are being told two different histories. And yes, there are some things that I think have been known, but we just don't want to address. And I think it's time to address it. You can't pick up the Bible, and I said this before online, you can't pick up the Bible and study, you know, an African book and understand the 2300 day prophecies, but ignore the 400 years and not understand the 400 years of that African people have had on this soil. We can't keep looking at this eschatological framework where we're talking about going to a heaven where there's every nation, language, kindred, tongue of people, but then we have a problem with somebody because of the problem of the color of their skin or because of their national origin, right? We can't, how can we properly read the Exodus and only look at the perspective of Pharaoh and not look at the perspective of the slave, the 400 years that they put up with? We understand that context, but apparently when we're talking about this from in our churches, and the reason why I'm saying this is because one of the most segregated hours is on the weekend when we go to church. There's a total framework. There's a reason why even in the West, somebody said it the other day and I thought it was hilarious. They said, is the Holy Spirit manifesting more than other conferences because the West keeps saying that we need to break down the structure, but they gather together based on the same cultural context anyway. The black churches are still black churches. The white churches are still white churches. They still have coordinators. We have conferences, right? So the engagement needs to happen on a local level where we stop making jokes about people based on where they're from. We stop saying, you know, that they have a chip on their shoulder and recognize that when you spend time, that we're all in the matrix and Jesus is the one to open our eyes to what's going on. We are all in the, you can tweet that. We are all in the matrix, all of us.
And Jesus is the one who brought the key out for us to get out of this situation so we can see clearly on what's going on. Because my white brother and my Asian brother, whatever, they're not my enemy. They are literally part of my bloodline. And we need to see each other as human beings once again and as children of God. And I think that can happen, but we have to stop assuming that people are upset for no reason. Only people who have had the luxury of not worrying about life can make those kind of claims. And that's regardless of whatever color or status you are. When you have a life of ease, you don't worry about what happened in order for your life to be easy. There are other people whose lives are difficult. And I'll say this final part about the race thing, and I'll shut up. You know, I've heard a lot of people make these comments about, you know, there are other people have been enslaved, and other people go through hard times, and other people. Okay, let's address that very quickly. Yes, other people have had hard times, but skin wasn't probably the reason. And that's what makes this whole dynamic different. Yes, you have dealt with oppression because you're a woman. Yes, you have dealt with stuff because you weren't born in the U.S. But there's a different dynamic when you cannot change your skin complexion, and there are laws on the books and there's systems in place where literally in our parents' generation, not our grandparents, in my father and mother's lifetime, sitting in the restaurant next to a white person was a no in the United States. So we're always talking like making this as distant. There's documentation that shows that slavery in its practice ended. They found one of the last slaves in the 1960s and interviewed him. They were still practicing it illegally. So we have to, the effort that we take to break down biblical prophecy and to understand scriptures and to look at Greek and Hebrew and to understand the scientific world around us and do all these different things, we take concerted effort to do that. But a quick Google search, a quick reading of a book will show us that we still have slavery occurring today on U.S. soil, but we've done it through privatized prisons and through the education and through the public school system. And there's a reason why prisons are private now and where they get their RRI. So I would just ask people as children of God to read up on that. And then we can always have that conversation after the fact. Our brothers and sisters, and it no longer needs to be a black problem or something that black people need to take care of. It is now everybody's problem because racism is dangerous. It's an existential threat to is the sin of partiality that came from the Bible that God on more than one occasion had to check people on because it literally can threaten people's existence. It's harmful, it's dangerous, but we can change the direction of this if we all see each other as children of God. And we ask God to help us in the transforming and the renewing of our mind.
Pastor, I could listen to you all day. Could you just, this is some powerful stuff that you stated on this podcast. Could you just let people know where they can find you? You have the podcast, but do you have any social media handles? Because I'm sure people after this episode are going to be like, I need to listen to this guy some more.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate it. You go to Instagram, type in The Unpreached Truth, The Unpreached Truth, no underscores, no spaces. You can also look for Nikolai X Graves, Nikolai X as in Malcolm X, Graves. And there's the link for that. That would lead to the podcast as well. Also on Facebook, same situation, The Unpreached Truth, God and Money. Or Nikolai X Graves, and we can take things from there. And every now and then I write some posts. Posts come up and we try to talk about some stuff. But so that's where you can catch you. That's where you can catch me. And I hope it honestly is a blessing. Listen, the podcast is free. Amen. Ain't nobody shouting the rooftop. The podcast is free. So it is a gift for people to better themselves in terms of how to deal with their finances and how to deal with their lives and to know that God cares about them if their bank account is negative or if their bank account is very high and positive.
Awesome. And so, Pastor, as I usually do, I give it to the guests to give some words of encouragement. So my question for you today is, can you give some words of encouragement to that youth leader who isn't really good with money and is trying to scrounge up as much as they can to, you know, not only take care of their family, but also do some activities with the young people, because, you know, that always costs money. Mm-hmm. What words of encouragement would you give?
Bible says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean on to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. I can testify that God will open opportunities for you to resolve your finances, to take care of issues of debt, to help bring clarity on how to create a budget, put you in contact with people who are on a similar journey, and even be able to resolve some challenges that you have. And as long as you put God first, he will take care of these things that we often worry about. Worry doesn't add to your life. It actually scientifically shortens it. So the smarter choice would be asking God for help. If you don't know where to start, then there are many times and many days, even as a pastor, I don't know where to start. I go to God in prayer, I calm down, and I watch God work. And watching God work means that I have to work with God, or sometimes I got to sit back and wait and be patient, or sometimes God will be like, okay, you got to go after this opportunity. But just like the widow who the man of God said that you need to go get jars, and the more jars you get, the more oil will go in there. You need to run out and look for opportunities for God to help you out in terms of whatever financial situation you're dealing with. So you could be in a season where you're not sure where you're going to work. The unemployment rate is going up. You are concerned about whether you're going to school or not, or what the future may hold. You don't have to worry about the resource. You have to worry about connecting to the source. If you connect to God, he will open the floodgates of heaven. So it's not even about that thing where we like to tell people, put the tithe in the plate, and then somehow you get blessed. The blessing is God. You connect to God, and God will do way more than you can ask or even imagine, because you were designed and made for a purpose. There's nobody else on the planet who is like you. And so your existence is not just a testimony to God's creative genius, but it also means that there's something that you're here for. And that thing may be so unique that you may be the first person to accomplish it or the last person to finish it. The point is, God has a plan. You're not going to know it. You're not going to know all the details. But if you connect with him, he will make straight your path.